Well, good morning, church. It's so good to be with you this morning. My name is Kevin Sneed, and I'm the teaching pastor here at CPC. And as you can probably tell, that this morning's a little bit different as I'm on screen, not with you in person. But you know, from the beginning of the pandemic, the elders and us as a church have decided to navigate our decision-making through three principles: adapt, protect, and provide. And earlier this week, or actually late this week, someone in my family tested positive for COVID-19. And given those three guiding principles, as well as the availability of technology, we just decided it would be best to pre-record the sermon so that we can play it in the sanctuary this morning. So I'm standing here in an empty sanctuary on Friday, mid to late afternoon, getting to share this sermon. And so I'm grateful that I can still be with you even through this. Well, this morning, we're starting a brand new series, a habit series. It's the first ever of its kind at CPC. And what we're doing in this series is expanding or taking our first step into our shared rule of life as a church. If you've been with us for the past 5 weeks, we've been talking about this new vision that we believe God has us kind of moving towards over the next 4 to 5 years. And this vision is about coming around and following Jesus collectively through a similar set of habits and practices. And so this morning, we take our first step in that. We begin to practice attentiveness to God through cultivating a habit of silence and solitude. So for the next few weeks, we'll be preaching into this. We have community group curriculum that's off and running. We've got practice labs coming up down the way. We'll have conversations about silence and solitude on our podcast. And we would love for you to engage at whatever capacity God is leading you into as well. Well, I want to start with a question. When was the last time you experienced sheer silence? When is the last time that you didn't hear a podcast or music, the roar of traffic, planes flying overhead? When was the last time you experienced a long period of silence? You know, silence is nearly impossible in our world. I think of the complexities of the Bay Area and how fast-paced it is. And for most of us, we can't even escape the sheer noise, the kind of white noise that is living in this area. And even if we're able to escape that noise, most of us actively avoid silence because we tend to think of it as something that must be endured rather than entered into. You know, they've done studies that have pursued the question of when does silence become, quote, awkward silence? And what they found is for the average American, 4 seconds of unplanned silence is when it becomes awkward silence. Even if it's planned silence, what they're finding is that the average American adult can't endure 20 to 30 seconds of planned silence before they begin to squirm and get a little bit uncomfortable. You see, most of us are pretty uncomfortable with the idea of silence. We live in a noisy world. I mean, think about our regular rhythms. When you get home, one of the first things you probably do if you're like me is you turn on the TV. Or maybe you put on music. You get in your car and you plug in a podcast or the next kind of whatever album you're listening to. When you get on an airplane, one of the first things I do is I pop my AirPods in and tune out the rest of the world and begin to listen to whatever it is. I mean, we live in a noisy, noisy world. There's an author named Richard Swenson who's a futurist, and he wrote this, or he kind of envisions about where culture may be going in the years to come, and he wrote this book called Margin. And in this book, what he did is he was trying to track in recorded human history the rate of change in culture. And so he goes all the way back to the year 3000 BC, so 5,000 years ago, and he begins to kind of track the big, large cultural changes that have taken place. And 5,000 years ago was essentially when humans started recording history. And what he found is that between 3000 AD and the present, the line has been almost completely flat with just this subtle bit of change as the years and centuries progress on. But the whole book is really his thesis, his claim, is that in the past 40 years, we as a culture have experienced more change than the previous 5,000 years combined. See, what complicates this idea of noise and stepping into silence is this progress of change. The world has changed so rapidly over such a short period of time that for most of us, we don't even remember a time before all of this radical change. And we see more and more, as we've been talking about the past couple of weeks, we've talked about this problem of acceleration in our world. I mean, think of just something like transportation. The way we've moved from horse and buggy into the automobile, into trains and planes and all of this. Think of now how you can stand on a street corner, pull your phone out and hail an Uber or a Lyft within moments and get wherever you desire. The world has changed radically fast. And in that, the world has gotten more and more noisy. You know, I think for most of us, I used this image last week, but on your screen, we've got this image where most of us are this picture on the left, where we're this squiggly line mess, where life feels chaotic, and we seem to bounce from one thing to the next over and over and over again. Well, part of the noise, part of the speed of this world is what propels us into this sort of squiggly, chaotic mess of life. But what we're looking to do in this vision with trying to step into these particular habits in the way of Jesus is look more like the picture on the right that says, how can we organize in the midst of this chaos, in the midst of this anxious, kind of fast-paced world, can we organize our life in such a way where Christ becomes that organizing principle around us? You know, I've had so many good conversations with many of you over the past few weeks as you guys have been talking and sharing your reflections on the past sermon series. And so many of you have shared, you know, this looks different for me in my stage of life. You know, we have many empty nesters. We have those who are retired. We've got moms of young children and dads of older high school kids and students and those who aren't married yet and singles and all these different types of people. And yes, there's a difference in the way we experience the fast-paced world, and there's a difference in how we apprentice under Jesus. But one of the important steps is recognizing that at any stage of life, there are different complexities. But if Swenson is right, and the pace of change has been as rapid and drastic in the past 40 years than the previous 5,000 combined, then regardless of stage of life, there's a new kind of way to live in this world that has never been experienced. And so all of us, regardless of stage of life, have to begin to ask those questions. What does this look like for me? Because it will look different. Stepping into a habit of silence and solitude will look different for the empty nester, as it will for the college student, as it will for the family with young kids, to the single adult. It will always look different, but nonetheless, this modern world we swim in that's kind of covered in speed and change will still require us to somehow resist that ongoing onslaught of pace of life and margin, or lack of margin. So what I want us to ask this morning is simply, what is that counter habit? What does silence and solitude look like in the life of Jesus, our rabbi, our savior, the one in which we are apprenticing under? What does the habit look like for him? And then what would it look like for you and for me as well? So if you have your Bible, I want you to flip to Matthew chapter 3. We're going to look at a small text, and then we're going to look at a lot of different texts where this habit of silence and solitude pops up into the life of Jesus. But as you're turning there, I want to read this quote from Susan Muto, who says this. She says, "In a noise-polluted world, it is even difficult to hear ourselves think, let alone try to be still and know God. Yet it seems essential for our spiritual life to seek some silence, no matter how busy we may be. Silence is not to be shunned as empty space, but to be befriended as fertile ground for intimacy with God." I love that phrase at the end where she says that silence is not something to be shunned, but is to be befriended. You see, again, most of us avoid silence, but yet what we see in the life of Jesus, what we'll see in a moment, is that he befriended silence and solitude. He embraced it as part of the own vitality of his own spirituality and discipleship, and so too we must come to that place of embracing and befriending silence if we are to grow and resist the sort of pull of always on, always faster, always distracted in our world around us. So Matthew chapter 3, let's pick up in verse 13. It says this, "Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, 'I need to be baptized by you, and do you come to me?' Jesus replied, 'Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness.' Then John consented." So this is a big moment in the life of Jesus, right? Jesus is walking through this process of baptism. It's really the launch of his public ministry and life. And so he goes out into the wilderness, he meets John the Baptist, and he says, John, it's time for you to baptize me. And John, being the humble man he is, says, listen, I need to be baptized by you, not the other way around. But Jesus kind of says, no, like to fulfill all righteousness, you need to do this. And so John finally gives into that. And let's pick up in verse 16. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water, and at that moment, heaven opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove, alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, this is my Son whom I love, and with him I am well pleased. Now consider for a moment the scene. Jesus being baptized in the Jordan River, coming out of the water, and it says that the heavens tore open, a voice of God comes down and says, this is my Son whom I love and am well pleased. I mean, what a scene, what a moment. Well, let's pick up in verse 4. It says, then Jesus was led by the Spirit. This immediately follows the scene we just read. It says, then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And after fasting 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, if you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. And Jesus answered, it is written, man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Now, did you catch that at the beginning? In verse 4, chapter 1, it says, chapter 4, verse 1, it says, then Jesus was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Now, has that ever struck you as odd? That Jesus was led by the Spirit, at the Spirit's direction and leading, taken out into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Like, why would the Spirit lead Jesus into that particular scene? Well, I mean, theologically, if you've been reading from Genesis 1, you would understand that at some point, Jesus was going to come face to face with the tempter, with the devil. And so we know that kind of theologically, but it still seems odd that the Spirit would lead Jesus out into the wilderness. For what we come to find out in verse 2, he spends 40 days and 40 nights alone fasting. And it's then that the devil comes in and tempts Jesus. And if you're like me, I always heard this story as a kid and thought, man, isn't that crafty like the devil to come to Jesus in a moment of weakness, after spending 40 days fasting and alone? Of course the devil comes then to tempt, to catch him at his weak moment. And so why then would the Spirit lead Jesus into the wilderness for that? Well, just a little while ago, I was listening to a pastor preach on this text, and he raised the point that I had missed all along. He says, listen, it's not so much that in the desert after the fasting and solitude and silence for 40 days and 40 nights alone that Jesus was weak, but rather if the Spirit led Jesus there, it's actually after that 40 days that Jesus is at the pinnacle of his spiritual power. See, the Spirit led Jesus into the wilderness because he knew this time out in the middle of the wilderness would be a space of strength for Jesus. It would be a place where he communes with God with such connection and vitality that it would give him the power to overcome Satan's temptations. See, I had the story wrong the whole time. Fasting and silence and solitude is not a space of weakness, but rather it's a source of strength. Now, it says there in verse 4 that the Spirit led Jesus into the wilderness. Now, the Greek word for wilderness is one we looked at a couple months ago now in the Gospel of Mark, but it's this word eremos. And eremos has a wide semantic range where it can mean wilderness, desert, or lonely place. It can also mean desolate, solitary, quiet. I mean, it has this broad range of understanding, but really what it's getting at least the connotation of eremos, is this sort of space in which you are deserted, away from everything and everyone. You're in a sort of uncultivated, desolate place. And so when Jesus is led by the Spirit into the eremos, he's led out into this sort of vast, open nothingness where he alone is now encountering Jesus and the Spirit. So it says when Jesus was led there in verse 1, he's experiencing this silence and solitude. He's communing with God in such a way as to gain that power and that strength from the Holy Spirit, intentionally led out into the eremos. You see, the eremos, which we'll see in a second, is one of Jesus' favorite places to be, is not a source of weakness, but of strength. The eremos, this wilderness where you go out and you kind of separate from everything around you to encounter the very presence of God. See, this eremos is a powerful place. It's a place we all need. It's a place where Jesus would escape the crowds. He'd escape the demands of his disciples. He'd escape the threats of the religious elites who would want to be after him. See, the eremos was this sort of place of solace, where he would fill up his tank and find himself in a place of sort of spiritual power. You see, this is so counter to the way we in the world think, right? We think of kind of power as being one where you have influence and you're filled with words and positional power and prestige and all of those things, that is where you rise to a position of power. But for Jesus, his source of power was nothing like that. It was actually escaping away from where all the people were. For Jesus, the source of power was in silence and solitude. It was separated from the crowd, separated from all the noise, separated from the chaos of daily life. This was the place of power for Jesus, the eremos, this wilderness, the set apart place. And what you find for the careful reader of the Gospels, again, is that this wilderness or quiet place, or you'll see it translated differently throughout the Gospel accounts of Jesus' life, but in all of these moments, you'll see that Jesus has this sort of eremos rhythm, where over and over he returns back to this wilderness throughout his public ministry. You see him step into this eremos kind of in reflection to times of busy work and ministry. He'll retreat away to rest, to reconnect with God. You'll see him go out to minister, go out to be with the disciples to teach, and then once again retreat into the wilderness to then engage back. There's a sort of cadence, a rhythm in which Jesus oscillates between work and rest with God. And in the eremos, what you really find is two different things, and Jesus experiences both. In the eremos, you experience an external silence, where you are separated from the noise. I think of something like Carmel down on the coast of California. I think of maybe it's up in Mendocino in the Northern California coast, or out in the desert in Death Valley or whatnot. Like in these spaces, you separate and you can then experience a sort of external silence. And Jesus experiences this external silence. It disconnects from him from the demands of modern life. It pulls kind of all the input around him. It separates him from that, where he can experience some peace of mind. But even more so, what Jesus experiences in the eremos is internal silence. It's in this place where you can be, you kind of silent. Silence becomes this sort of eremos experience, this internal silence, more of a sort of state of mind than it is a particular position. And it's an internal silence that you begin to slow down enough where Jesus could stop the sort of busyness of the thought life and of the mind in a way in which he could just reconnect with God and God alone. He could refocus, he could recenter. And see, the eremos is this connection between external and internal silence, where it begins to be the place of rejuvenation for you. Listen to the way Richard Foster in his magisterial book, Celebration of Discipline, describes this. He says, in the midst of noise and confusion, we are settled into deep inner silence. And he's talking about this habit. He says, whether alone or among people, we always carry with us a portable sanctuary of the heart. See, I love this because internal silence can be done anywhere. You can find a sort of internal silence on BART on your way across to the East Bay, or you can find it in a car ride where you stop music and don't put on the podcast, but just drive. And even external silence, you can find it, yes, out on the coast or in the forest or in Tahoe or out wherever, but you can also find it in the anonymity of a downtown urban cafe. I think often one of my favorite places to work is I go to a local coffee shop and usually I drive up into the city and I put my AirPods on and I don't put music on, but often I'll just put noise canceling on and I'll sit in a sort of silence and solitude where, yes, there's external noise, but it's sort of white noise. There's people around, but there's an anonymity there where I can experience a sort of what Foster calls a portable sanctuary of the heart. See, this eremos we can carve out and create in different places in our life, in different rhythms in our life. It's less about the physical location as it is about the posture of your being and your own heart. What I want to demonstrate really quick is I want you to see how much Jesus loved the eremos. So I'm going to rapid fire a whole bunch of texts here at you. And I just want to do it not to exegete every text, but simply to let you see the sort of onslaught that the gospel writers write about this eremos, this wilderness that Jesus loved so much. So in the text we just read, right, we see Jesus inaugurating his ministry by spending 40 days alone in the desert. In Luke chapter 6, verse 12, before Jesus selects and chooses the 12 disciples, the text reads this. One of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray, that's eremos, and spent the night praying to God. Matthew 14, 13, after hearing of the death of his friend John the Baptist, we read that when Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. A little bit later, Matthew 14, 23, shortly after Jesus feeds the 5,000, it says this, after he dismissed them, Jesus sends the crowds and the disciples away, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone. Mark 1, 35, following a long night of ministry, his first day on the job, we read this, very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Luke 5:16, following Jesus healing the leper, it says, but Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. Matthew 17:1-9, the Mount of Transfiguration, we see Jesus retreating away with three of his best friends so he can escape the crowd and the chaos. The text says this, after 6 days, Jesus took him with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain to be by themselves. Matthew 26:36-46. Right in the night before Jesus goes to the cross, we see that beautiful and agonizing scene where he's in the Garden of Gethsemane alone in prayer, and with such connection and anguish, he begins sweating blood. Before the high point of Jesus' ministry, he escapes away because he needed to tap into the eremos. He needed that eremos rhythm to fill him with spiritual power for what he was about to do. One more in Mark chapter 6. After the disciples were sent out to preach and to heal and do ministry, they come back and they return to Jesus. And the first thing Jesus says for them to do is he says this in Mark 6:31. Then, because so many people were coming and going, they did not even have a chance to eat. And he said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. The eremos was clearly one of Jesus' favorite places. Over and over and over in the gospel accounts, you see him retreating away from the crowds, not to escape and be some sort of recluse, but rather to fill up, connect with God, be present to that which was most important, and then begin to re-engage in ministry around him. Now, for most of us, again, we live in a world of increasing change and acceleration and busyness and fast pace and distraction that many of us resonate actually with this Mark 6 text, don't we? That the disciples get back from work and they don't even have time to eat. I mean, most of us, again, we just struggle to put dinner on the table in a way in which we can slow down and eat with our families. He says, but we're so busy, we can't even eat. Like, there's no way I could actually carve out a sort of silence. But what I want you to see is you're not alone. If you have a hard time even thinking through, how am I going to slow down to eat my next meal, or how am I going to carve out a space to be silent, you're not alone. The disciples understood this. Jesus understood this. But what we need is this sort of eremos rhythm. I mean, notice again what Jesus says. He says to these disciples as they came back in Mark 6 from all of this ministry, he says, come away with me by yourselves so that we can escape away and binge the next season of Stranger Things. Or he says, come away with me so we can get away on a vacation and kick up and rush around sightseeing, all that. He says, no. He says, come away with me and we'll just kind of lounge by the pool and kick all that. No, what Jesus says is something different. He says, come away with me by yourselves to the eremos so you can get some rest. You see, most of us in the modern world confuse leisure with rest. And there's nothing wrong with those examples I just described. There's nothing wrong with vacationing by the pool or watching that season of Netflix or of Stranger Things or whatever it is. There's nothing wrong with that. And no one should feel guilty for watching a show at the end of the night. Absolutely, that's fine. He says, but what your soul needs is rest. And there's a difference between leisure and there is in rest. And that leisure is not a bad thing, but it's not rest for your soul. And Jesus looks at these disciples, he looks at us, and he says, come, get away with me to the eremos and experience rest, soulful rest. See, when we get to the end of binging whatever show it is or just camping out on the couch forever when we're tired and we just flop down and we just flip on whatever we can to distract us, most of us at the end of that experience don't think, man, I feel better. Most of us are not genuinely rested at a soul level at the end of that. What we need is an eremos rhythm where we recognize the weariness of our souls. See, what Jesus understood, what he's trying to teach us, and as apprentices of him, we need to learn how to take on these very habits and practices of his life so that we can begin to live the life of Christ, is we need rest for our souls. We need silence and we need solitude. That somewhere in this habit, we find a sort of regeneration of our very souls. You could define solitude this way. Solitude is simply time away, time alone. Again, in the physical location of a cabin in the woods or in the anonymity of downtown in an urban area, but whatever it is, we need time where we disconnect from the sort of busyness of our lives. Solitude cracks open the shell of our own insecurities and it opens up the whole of our lives and all that's within us. You see, in solitude, we can no longer be and live off a codependency of others and their approval. But rather in solitude, why most of us avoid that is because it opens our life up and we're laid vulnerable before God just as we are. And for many of us, we don't want to face that. It's in solitude that we sever ourselves from the intoxicating feeling of being the center of attention. We practice not being needed and realize that we are not the grease that turns the wheel. It is doing to our false self, it's exposing our false self and our false sense of importance in a way that says, God, you are at the center of the universe, not ourselves. But it's only through this kind of presence of solitude that we find we're never actually fully alone, but rather in solitude, we are in the very presence of God and we lay our lives before God. It's different than isolation and loneliness. It's a sort of communion with God. On the other side, you could define silence as a sort of, it's the way Adele Calhoun describes it. She says, silence is a regenerative practice of attending and listening to God in quiet, without interruptions or with noise. See, silence is the way in which we disconnect from the noise and we just sit in the very presence of God. We find that sort of still small voice who's been calling to us and crying out to us all along. See, it's in silence that we free ourselves from the addiction to distraction and noise in order to be fully present to God. In silence, we loosen our perceived sense of control and are given the opportunity to practice simply being before God. Silence starves our ego because we can't rely on words to control others, ourselves, or God himself. But it's in silence when we stop speaking that we can't focus any longer on productivity or efficiency, but rather we just sit again laid bare before God. I don't think it's too big of a stretch to say that oftentimes an abundance of words brings about sin. that for many of us, the more words we say, the more trouble we get into. And this is coming from someone who more or less talks for a living. See, in silence, we disconnect. We can no longer self-justify. We cannot dismiss our behaviors or our deepest longings, because in silence, we release control of our lives and we lean into trusting God. Silence in solitude is fundamentally about trust. It's about laying the fullness of who we are before God and saying, God, we trust that we will still be loved by you. Silence and solitude forces us to confront ourselves. It forces us to confront our desire for God, or even maybe what we most fear, our lack of desire for God. It forces us to look inside, to recognize maybe the shell of who we want to be or become. But it's in silence that we are loved by God simply as who we are. I think you could define it this way: silence and solitude is intentionally separating oneself from the ordinary rhythm of life to be present with God and ourselves in the quiet. Now, before we move on, I also want to define silence and solitude by the things that they are not, because I think there's a few disclaimers that are important to note. First, silence and solitude is different than mindfulness, right? The past few years, mindfulness, this practice of mindfulness, has been kind of all the rage, particularly in business circles. And in mindfulness, it looks very similar to silence, but it is still a very different practice. I mean, mindfulness in our world, I mean, there's all sorts of apps and books that have been written about this practice, all of which I actually don't think are a bad thing. I think mindfulness in general is actually a pretty good practice, but it's not the Christian conception of silence and solitude. Listen to the way Rich Velotis, pastor in New York, writes about this distinction. He says, there's been much talk in our culture about the benefits of mindfulness. The difference between mindfulness and silent prayer is communion with a person. The object of mindfulness is often better psychological and physical health, very important things, but the object of silent prayer is communion with God. You see, the difference between mindfulness and silence and solitude is that in mindfulness, you are alone with yourself. Your aim is to kind of better get you into a better mental state or physical state. Again, those are good things, and I'm not down on those things. But the practice of silence and solitude, particularly in the way of Jesus, is radically different. It's about disconnecting from the noise and distraction of the world so we can commune with the very one true God. So it's in silence and solitude that we encounter communion with God. The second disclaimer, distinction I want to point out is that silence and solitude is not loneliness or isolation. You see, we can also confuse those two because they look alike. They look like when you seclude yourself into that kind of solitude that it feels like you're isolating or in loneliness. But there's a big distinction. See, we are created to be in community. And so when we see this rhythm of Jesus to escape from the crowds, it can't be that that's the end goal, to just, you know, kind of hole up as a recluse. But rather, in silence and solitude, it's a way to disconnect from all the demands and the pressures, not to escape them, but rather to say, I need to connect with God here. I need to bring God into this space. And so solitude is not loneliness or isolation. Richard Foster, in that book, Celebration of Discipline, I mentioned earlier, has this great line where he says, loneliness is inner emptiness. Solitude is inner fulfillment. Loneliness is inner emptiness, but solitude is inner fulfillment. See, solitude is different because it's where we go from feasting on others to feasting on God and allowing God to be the very core thing that fills us up from the inside out. You see, solitude fulfills us. Loneliness or isolation, well, it begins to slowly erode us. It's not what we are created for. Loneliness and isolation are often not voluntary things, but rather circumstances around you have forced you into those spaces. But solitude is a willful stepping into the eremos in order to be with God. And it's in silence and solitude that we see two dimensions of our own transformation. You know, in the same way that Jesus was experiencing that internal and external silence when he escaped the eremos, what happens in the eremos is those two dimensions, the internal self and the external self, these are the two things that are transformed. See, the first is the external self, the way in which we encounter the world around us and the people around us. When we create this eremos rhythm, our external selves are slowly kind of transformed. Because in the eremos, we detach from unhealthy codependencies. We don't pursue the approval of others. And so what we learn in the eremos is that the external self can come fresh to people around us in a new way, where we aren't seeking their approval or we aren't seeking their positive energy or whatnot, but rather we come to them to just love them as they are because we've learned to be loved as we are. It changes the way we interact with others around us. It's in silence and solitude that we grow in patience, that we grow in gentleness. All those fruits of the Spirit begin to swell up in us as we connect and live connected to the Holy Spirit. You see, it's in the silence and solitude that we learn how to be in community because we know how to be within ourselves. When you're confronted with your shadow side, it forces you to deal with it. And when we deal with our shadow side, we show up better in the world for those around us. And so slowly over time, the external self is also transformed. You know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote this beautiful little book called Life Together. And it was a book that he wrote about this kind of this grouping of pastors that he had in Finkenwald as Nazism was on the rise. And in this book, he's detailing what it means to truly live in community together. And he has this great line at the front, towards the beginning of the book, where he says, "Let him who cannot be alone beware of community. And let him who is not in community be aware of being alone. Each by itself has profound pitfalls and perils. One who wants fellowship with solitude plunges into the void of words and feelings. And one who seeks solitude without fellowship perishes in the abyss of vanity, self-infatuation, and despair." See, what Bonhoeffer understood is that if you're to show up to others and be with others, you need to know how to be alone. And if you want to show up alone and do the internal work, you've got to show up to be with other people. The day alone and the day together, they go in unison. You cannot have one without the other if we want to be healthy followers of Jesus. So as we do this eremos rhythm, the external self begins to be transformed. But what happens at maybe a deeper level is that the internal self begins to be transformed as well. You see, in silence, the internal self becomes vulnerable. As we slow down and face ourselves, we're confronted with all of the emotions that we've been numbing and distracting away from us. We face the good, the bad, and the ugly, the whole of our own heart and our own soul. In silence and solitude, in the eremos, the internal self is confronted where we can no longer run and hide from it, but rather it's just laid in front of us to bring before God for our own healing. It's in silence that we face our desire, our habits, our bad addictions, our egotistical motivations, whatever it is. It's in silence that we starve the ego, we starve the false self, and allow ourselves to just connect with God one-on-one. We cut through the cacophony of voices around us that are always pouring in and demanding more and more from us. We cut through those to hear the very voice of God and let him speak what is truest about us. That we are loved as his children. That we don't need the approval of others. We don't need this affirmation. We don't need all those external things. But rather, when we find our identity and we behold God, that becomes the animating part of our life. It transforms us from the inside out. See, it's this eremos rhythm that I'm convinced has the power, in conjunction with the Holy Spirit, where we begin to be transformed from the inside out. The internal self, the external self, begins to integrate into one whole, healthier human because God is working to transform us into his people. And in the eremos, in silence and solitude, we begin to take steps towards that. Well, on your way in today, you probably got one of these habit cards. And as we were kind of planning this series and talking through everything we wanted to do in this, we wanted this to be like very, very practical, that all of us could walk out of the sanctuary today with an idea of how to step into the Oremos. And so on this card, we've created just a starting practice and on one side and a stretch practice on the other. And there are four or five just really basic steps where if you've never experienced silent prayer, you've never wanted to try this idea of silence and solitude, you could pick up this card and at least it would give you it would point you in the right direction. So we encourage you to look at these. If you're in a community group, your sort of take-home exercise is going to be the exact same thing, where you're going to get the chance to practice silence and solitude this week, because church, we need it. Our world is so noisy. It is so loud. It is filled with all sorts of just noise and chaos and busyness. We must find a way to cut through that, to follow in the very steps of our rabbi Jesus and say, if Jesus needed this Oremos rhythm, then I would guess that we did as well. So I encourage you, take this card, find a way to kind of carve out space this week. And it starts with the starting practice with just a small kind of little step in, and then it grows on the stretch practice to cultivate a more daily rhythm with more time in silence and solitude. But listen, this, remember back a couple weeks ago when we talked about the trellis for the soul. All of this is just simply a tool that in a particular moment of our moment, we need to just follow Jesus a little more closely. So if for some reason it doesn't work for you, that's okay. Or if there's more that you already do, that's okay as well. This is just simply a practical tool you can take up to start to cultivate that sort of Oremos rhythm. But to close, I want to just end with a simple thought. You know, for most of us, and I think in kind of the modern evangelical church in particular, we have a sort of infatuation with celebrities, with people with influence and reach and all that. And I think what happens is over time, we've attached ourselves to somebody else's spirituality. But what we're inviting you into, what I think Jesus is inviting you into, is to kind of no longer live vicariously through someone else's spirituality. Not, you know, to stop living vicariously through a podcast or a preacher or a pastor or a friend. And what Jesus is inviting you into, what I'm inviting you into, is to begin to own your faith in a way where you experience God's presence firsthand, where you create and step out, and that can be difficult and challenging and hard. But at some point, we have to detach the sort of codependency on others and just say, I'm here to commune with you, God, all by myself. And in the Oremos, in the silence and solitude, we just take one small step towards that. And ultimately, we trust what Jesus would say in Matthew 11. The words that I kept coming back to this week is, come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Church, may we go to him. May we respond to that invitation. And this week, may we step into that Oremos, whatever that looks like for you, and just begin to lay ourselves before God, saying, God, we are weary, we are burdened, and what we need is rest. So church, I invite you into this habit of silence and solitude this week.